Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation today with Carl Berghofer of Embuto, New Mexico. He turns 95 this week, and he'll celebrate by doing what he does every day, tending to his orchards along the Rio Grande like he has for three quarters of a century. We're going to go back, though, to the year before he purchased that property, back to February 1945. Carl was an 18-year-old Marine on his way to Iwo Jima.
So many of the vets I've talked to who served on Iwo Jima, who fought in that battle,
yeah,
most of them had never heard of Iwo Jima before they got there.
Yeah, well, I never had heard of it.
Did you know where you were going when you headed that way?
Yeah, we found out aboard ship going up to Iwo after we loaded to Guam and went up to Iwo Jima, and they announced on the speaker system we were going to Iwo Jima. We got up there, and the 4th and 5th Division were the first waves ashore.
Right.
And the 5th Division went across the island, cut it in two, and then turned north on the west side, and the 4th Division landed on the east side of the beach and went up the east side. The 3rd Division was in reserve. My division was in reserve, and we went ashore on D+1. The evening of D+1, the 4th officers were suffering heavy casualties, and we went in to replace them, and we went up the center of the island.
You know, it's been famously said that the estimates were it would only take 3 days to take that island. Did they tell you guys that?
We were there for more than 30 days.
Well, and I imagine if they thought it was going to be over in 3 days, they probably didn't think they'd have to send the reinforcements in as early as you guys went in.
Yeah, we went in early.
And what did you see? Can you help us understand what it was like for you?
We watched it from the ship, and it was just a cloud of smoke and dust and bombing and artillery shells. And then when the Marines went ashore, they landed almost unopposed. And after they got ashore, then the Japanese opened up on them and tried to hit them at the beach. They hit a lot of the shell fire, hit a lot of the landing boats, LSTs and Higgins boats, and the beach was cluttered with torn up, destroyed ships. And we went ashore. We couldn't get to the beach, so we unloaded on an LST and climbed the rope ladder in the LST and then went off the ramp or get ashore.
Because there wasn't enough room from all the...
Yeah, all the wrecked vessels.
Wow.
They had boats in there trying to tug the boats, wrecked shell boats out off the beach.
You guys were going in a Higgins boat, in an LCVP, and then couldn't make it in?
We were going right at the heart of the shell fire on the beach.
I can't imagine what that must have felt like, to see all that in front of you and wonder what's going to happen to you.
Iwo Jima was, I still have dreams about that damn place. It was black sand and pumice. You'd take a step going up the terraces onto the beach. It was a series of terraces that were wind and water formed. You'd take a step up and you slide back a half a step. The only way you get up the terrace is get down to your hands and knees and crawl and get up on one terrace and take shelter and rest, and then you climb the next terrace.
And meanwhile, there's still incoming fire.
Yeah, we were under fire the whole time. But we made it up on the beach, and then we captured some of the Japanese foxholes and so on. And we went ashore. I'll never forget the smell. There was two smells I've never outlived. The smell of rotting dead bodies and blood, and the smell of sulfur. The whole island, that was named Iwo Jima because it was Sulfur Island, and it supplied a good part of the sulfur for the Japanese army. The whole island stunk of sulfur, and the center of the island was an extinct volcano, and then there's a volcano on the south, Mount Suribachi. That's the one that raised the flag on. I was on the beach when the flag went up, by the way. But the northern part of the island, you dig a foxhole down and dig those sulfur pumice bricks out, and they'd be plumb hot. They were hot enough to heat your K rations on.
Wow.
The smell of sulfur permeated the whole island.
Doesn't sound like a very comfortable place to be.
Well, it sure wasn't. They had three airstrips on the island. The reason we took it is capture those airstrips,
right,
and make a landing strip for returning B-29s coming from Japan, bombing Japan. Well, to put fighters on there to accompany the B-29s to Japan, give them fighter cover.
And that's something that some have debated over the years. Some have suggested, did we really need to take that island, especially at such a heavy cost?
Yeah, it was heavy cost.
And you, here you are, 18 years old.
Yeah, I just turned 18, about 18 and a half when I went to Iwo.
And you're seeing things you've never seen before.
Yeah, I got used to it in a hurry.
And you said something. You were on the beach when the flag went up.
Yeah, I was on the beach when the flag went up, and we were under shell fire. Then the ship's whistles all went off all around the island. All the ship whistles went off, and we looked up, and they had raised the first flag on Iwo Jima. It was a little flag. You could barely see it. They raised two flags. They won the one in the picture was the second flag.
Right. Did you see that one go up as well?
Yeah, I saw it go up as well.
Yeah, the story goes that James Forrestal, Secretary of the Navy, wanted the first flag as a personal souvenir, but Marine Lieutenant Colonel Chandler Johnson wanted to make sure it stayed with the 2nd Battalion, 28th Regiment, 5th Marine Division, that had made its way up Mount Suribachi to plant that flag. So Johnson issued orders to have a replacement flag sent up, and of course he said, make it a big one.
He thought the first flag was too small. It wasn't very big. I would say it was probably 3 by 4 feet.
And you said the ship's whistles were going off because they're all watching.
Yeah.
And they see this flag, and that signifies...
we were permanent possession of the island.
So for you, being on the beach and seeing that, what did that mean?
It was a big morale booster, believe me.
Did it come to register as a bit of false security as well, though, because of there was so much battle left to fight?
We knew we were firmly in possession of the island at that time, but we knew there was a lot of hard fighting ahead of us, and there sure was.
Because you had basically another month there after that.
Yeah.
What was that month like?
We made the assault on the second airstrip, my unit did. That was a bloody mess. The Japanese were dug on the other side, and we charged that airstrip, got across it, and captured the first trenches and trenchments. And I remember looking back, and there was dead and wounded Marines all across that airstrip. They got a lot of our people. After that, we had cover. That was the only uncovered attack we made, was across the airstrip. But the rest of the campaign, we were just one ridge and one foxhole to the next. We'd move ahead. Maybe take 50 yards in a day. Then at night, we could lay in our foxholes and we could feel the vibration of the Japanese digging out the caves underneath us. And the next day, there'd be as many Japanese behind you as there was in front.
Wow.
They had that whole island riddled with tunnels. You could go from one to the other of that probably 7 different ways and never go through the same hole twice.
Which makes it pretty difficult on you, I imagine.
Yeah.
And it sounds pretty exhausting.
We'd burn out with flamethrowers, burn out the tunnels and the caves we found, and then dynamite them shut. And that next night, the Japanese be digging them out and open them up again.
And you did some of that?
Yeah. I never did operate a flamethrower. I was a rifleman, but I'd carry shape charges and Bangalore torpedoes. Mm-hmm. They were real effective against the caves.
I'm just imagining being in your shoes, an 18-year-old kid dealing with all this.
Yeah, I got a rude awakening on Iwo, believe me.
Well, and it sounds like you never know where the enemy's coming from.
You never knew where they were coming from, and they were really dug in. We'd maybe make 50 yards a day, and then toward the last of the campaign, we made a night assault through the Japanese lines to the North Beach, and I was in the party, and we had about 18 or 20 men. Made the transfer to the North Beach. Our objective was to cut off the 4th and 5th Division that already completed the assault through the two flanks, right and left side of the island. And the 3rd Division was pretty well through the center of the island, but the Japanese had runners going back and forth to keep communications going between the right flank and the left flank. We went in there to break up that runner, and they covered us up that night. We were dug in right on the cliffs on the northern beach, where we could look right down to the ocean, and the Japanese covered us up that night. That was the only night I knew I was going to make it home, but we held them off that night, and then the next morning, the Marines advanced up on the top of the ridge above us, and they could fire down in there, and the Japanese withdrew.
So if they hadn't done that, you were surrounded, and you really had no way out of that.
Yeah, we had no way out of it. That was the only night I really gave up hope of coming home.
What's it like in that moment? What's the internal dialogue?
Actually, I was at peace with it. I never had a fear of dying. I just had a fear of captured and painful dying. The lot of the fellows with me felt the same way.
Well, and we know close to 7,000 Americans were killed on that island. Were there some guys that you had gotten to know that you lost there?
A lot of my platoons were killed. Binder and Sherman and Bohannon and a bunch of McChristensen.
These are all guys you knew?
Yeah, we're all killed on Evil.
How did you process that as an 18-year-old? How did you work through that?
We got to where we accepted it right quick. We accepted death as being a part of life. I never have had a fear of dying.
Why not?
I was raised in this area here where we had a lot of old people passed away, and my mother had always taught me that dying is part of life. You're born, you live, and you die. And all of creation is circular. It goes in a circle. The stars form, they live, and they die, and something else comes up between them. So everything is cyclic, and I've never had I don't want to die, but I have no particular fear of it. I know it's inevitable, and I was raised that way.
So you mentioned the night where you're surrounded, and you said that's the first time you thought, I'm not going to make it out of here.
Yeah.
Were there some other close calls that you experienced before the day you were wounded?
Yeah, I was digging a foxhole on the north side of an observation hole. It was up on a high place. Our platoon was dug into the lower part of the ridge, and they had a little point come up, and we were asked to go up and push up from rocks and dig us a foxhole on top of this little ridge where we could see the Japanese coming in at night. They'd crawl in and get close to your foxhole, and sometimes they'd jump in with a live grenade and pop a grenade and jump the foxhole with you. Other times they'd get up close and just drop a couple of grenades in your foxhole with you. And they were really wizards at crawling in at night when the star shells were off. They would move ahead a ways, and then they'd cover up, and they were hard to see. And we dug an observation post with rocks and holes between the rocks so we could look out and not outline our helmets above the rocks. We were digging that foxhole. There was a great big flat sulfur rock in the bottom. I lifted it up and I raised it up, and I had to raise my head above to land over the side of the foxhole for reinforcement. And this Japanese machine gunner cut a layer of rock over and hit that rock and blew gravel at my face. He'd have been a tenth of an inch higher, he'd have cut me in two.
A tenth of an inch?
Yeah.
That's pretty close. If that rock hadn't have been there,
Rock hadn't been there, I wouldn't have made it.
Yeah, wow.
I had several close calls. I had lots of bullets pass within 6 inches of me. You could hear the crack of the bullet and feel the pressure, air pressure. Then I got out of the Marine Corps. I was still in the Marine Corps when my folks called me and told me this piece of property I'm living on now is for sale. So they went ahead and bought it, and then I paid for it after the GI loan after I got out of the service. And I've kept this for retirement property ever since. I got out of the Marine Corps, went back to work for the Navy Peace Department, took some non-credit college courses, and finished my GED at high school, and went into game management. I worked for them for 32 years. Then after I left the Game and Fish Department, we formed the first ambulance service. My wife was a nurse at the hospital down the road here. She was out there. She was working one day, and a guy had an accident of a canyon. She took my station wagon and went up there and got the girl out. She was really badly hurt. And they brought her into the hospital and stabilized her, and then they hauled her by station wagon on to Albuquerque for more intensive care. A short time later, there was a guy showed up and wanted to see her ambulance. He wanted to thank us for what we did for the daughter. And Faith pointed the old station wagon out there, and he says, I'm going to get you a new ambulance. So about a month later, a guy drove up with a new Dodge van, all equipped with gurneys and everything in it, and shelves for medication, for our equipment, and we formed the first ambulance north of Albuquerque.
Wow.
Before that, they'd send a hearse out and pick you up, and if you lived, they took you to the doctor. If you didn't live, they took you to the morgue. So we had the first ambulance service. It was a busy service.
Wow. Well, there's so many directions we can go here.
Manned by volunteer EMTs.
Well, you talked about a couple close calls there on Iwo, but I've got to hear about the day you were wounded. Do you remember what day that was?
Yeah, that was March 15th, 1945.
If that day had unfolded a little bit differently, we would not be having this conversation with Carl Berghofer of Embuto, New Mexico. It's time for our final break, but we'll hear his Purple Heart story in vivid detail when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.